Interview with John Siegenthaler. Editor, Nashville, Tennessean, August 15th, 1974.
Politics and Government, Tennessee, by a group on the hill.
On the hill? I think it's... spotty, but... I'm satisfied with... Well, that's not fair to say I'm satisfied with our coverage. I think our coverage is better than... most papers in the state have, primarily because I think we put more people into it. Just because, say, when the legislature's meeting, we're willing to put more people up there than the other papers are. And manpower is a big problem. Nobody does an adequate job covering local or state government. But I think that our two key fellows up there, Larry Daughtry and John Hale, are better than average. Tough, skeptical, cynical. Energetic. Hale was more of a self-starter than Daughtry. Daughtry's more thorough. I think they do the best job they can do in terms of the time that's available to them. After that, I'd rate Dana high. Dana may be better as an individual than either one of them. Also tough, also cynical, also more energetic probably than any other reporter up there. Travis has gotten lazy a little bit, knows more, but doesn't move around as much as he used to. Bill Bennett, I think, is, by my standards, almost inadequate. He's routine with him, the commercial feed. The Banner, I think they're spotty, pretty spotty. Electronic media is almost, there's almost nobody there that cares. I think in terms of trying to keep politicians from just picking it up and carrying it away, or the lobbyists from picking up and carrying it away, I think most people would say that Tennessean is aggressive almost to the point of being a common scold at times, and after that, Dana is the toughest guy up there. But again, we just don't do enough. I go up there doing the legislature sometimes, sit in the balcony, and it startles me to think, got all those reporters crammed into those two halls, and almost nobody covering the rest of state government. You know, just not an adequate job. And I've suggested a couple times informally that we're trying to fool some, but nobody wants to do that. I don't know why.
The wire services do anything?
Very little. Very little. Almost nothing. They rely on us most heavily for coverage. Yeah. As I say, we have those two fellows, and they're not able to do anything like the job that ought to be done. But I think they work at keeping them relatively honest, and if we get on to something and some, you know, we get on to something, then, and they're tied up, then we throw somebody else into it, like, well, the whole question of strip mining came up about that. We had one reporter who was working that whole area, and he moved in and attacked state government, attacked the problem from the way state government was dealing with it. And if there's some consumer question that comes up, or some local government question that comes up for the legislature, property appraisal was a big issue for a while. one of our local government fellows was out, Al Gore Jr. was working on that. And the legislature had some hearings on it, so he went in and covered that, as opposed to the two reporters who were up there. He just knew more about it.
Was he the senator's son?
Mm-hmm.
Writes very well.
Damn well. Again, he's... You know, as long as reporters are tough enough and skeptical enough, they're going to do a reasonably good job, unless they're just lazy. And I find that most of the fellows around here come in here really come because they know there's enough freedom to go into government at either level, state or local, without any interference. There aren't going to be that many sacred cows, and there aren't. Some, but not that many.
How do you assess the state of the Democratic Party in Tennessee?
Well, it almost has no substance as a structure.
We heard a description of the Democratic Party in North Carolina as being likened to a bird with no head and many wings flapping simultaneously in different directions. And my question is, does that also describe the Democratic Party in Tennessee?
Yeah, I guess it does. Yeah, I think that's damn good. Incidentally, my son's going to Duke starting in September. He's really looking forward to it. On the edge. But, so I expect I'll know a hell of a lot more about North Carolina politics next year than I do this year. But, you know, I guess it's, you go through transitions from an old South one-party state to a viable two-party state. And it's difficult to know, particularly where you don't have party registration. It's difficult to know what the hell a party is. We had two factions in Tennessee since Crump, really. Franklin and Buford Ellington were not Crump machine politicians in the boss Crump sense, but they did inherit, they were heirs to that wing of the party. You know, and it matured some, and but if you go down the list of Crump machine county leaders, quite often they turn up in the Clement Ellington faction of the party. At least a half dozen county leaders. Some of them still around. Not many. Howard Warp comes to mind down in Hohenwald. He was front man for years and years. And postman, McKellar named him postmaster. Fired for the Hatch Act violation. Well, later on he wound up on the state school board under Clement, later became state commissioner of education under Ellington. And he's still down in that little county, still controlling 70% of the vote. His wife, I think, is now school superintendent down there. He was for years. Clement Ellington really, when they put it together, took on most of that organization. I guess it gravitated where the power was when Frank Clement came in as a young star in 52. The anti-Crump faction, which never had that many identifiable bodies before Estes P. Faulkner and Gordon Browning by 1948. They represented really the other faction, the out faction. Gore came into that whole thing. But Gore and P. Faulkner were strange politicians. They were basically populists. No tangible organization in terms of structure. No, there were no chief of county leaders who dispensed patronage. Not that many, because there was not that much patronage. You know, I mean, the congressman got into it, or he had to divide it with Albert, or whoever the other senator was. So from about 52 on, the Democratic Party was just two sharply divided factions, the Clement Ellington organization and the Kefauver Gore non-organization, just sort of an amorphous group of people that senators often not around this newspaper's positions. And we really haven't gotten used to being a party that fights Republicans, you know. Because they used to fight with each other. And still very bitter, very bitter. It's, still find people for Democrats who hate Annabelle Clement, or Gore Democrats, who hate Dudley Crockett, who is sort of Buford Ellington's press secretary. I don't think we've really gotten used to the idea of being a party yet, having an organization, having party chairman who had any say-so about issues or structure or organization. And Jim Sass has provided some leadership, some direction, since he's come in, and he probably was the right man at the right time.
What's it going to take to do that, to make it a party? I mean, this last primary doesn't indicate that there's much organization in the sense that you're keeping candidates out.
That's right. Well, this, of course, this campaign could do it. Certainly the next one will. What we need is a leader around whom Democrats can gravitate.
Is Blanton the guy for that?
Well, he's not for me. You know, I'm going to have to decide what I want to do about that. I supported Howard Baker over him because of his record on civil rights, civil liberties. And it was a close endorsement for Baker, but we came down for Baker. It's the first time this paper has endorsed a Republican since 1937 when Silliman Evans bought it. But Blanton was a redneck congressman from a redneck district, and I didn't feel like I wanted him to
How is he going to be as a statewide candidate for governor?
When he came in and talked to us and asked for our endorsement in the primary, we didn't endorse in the primary. He said, never so many candidates spent so much, talked so much, said so little. Really, so that's, I think that's the way a lot of people felt about it. Only the candidates that we might have supported were out of it almost from the beginning. But when he came in, we said to him, look, you lost a hell of a lot of black votes, large numbers of labor votes, when you ran against Howard Baker. You know, how do you intend to get them back? And he said something to the effect, well, I'll have to make some overtures in those directions and others. I just don't know if he's deep enough to command the sort of respect that I think is really needed to attract people like Lita Freeman to the Democratic Party. I mean, the wing of the Democratic Party that's been out in terms of state government and state party is concerned. I mean, they've had people in office. I mean, Kefauver was in office, Albert Gore was in office. But particularly congressmen around, has been satisfactory. But those people are basically motivated, I think, by a sense of idealism and a commitment to politics outside patronage. I'm not sure that even that coalition can continue to survive in the 70s in Tennessee. But there has been a labor, black, academic community coalition that found real inspiration in people like Kefauver and Gore, and even in Ross Bass, poor fellow. But he was sort of in that image. I don't think Ray Blanton has said anything or done anything to make any of them want to get off their ass. So I think the answer is no. I don't think that he has the capacity to provide that sort of leadership. However, I suspect that when Bill Brock comes up in 2 years, it won't matter who the party's nominee is, whoever he is. The Gore, Kefauver wing of the party wants Bill Brock badly. Whether they can get him again is something. Whether they can get him is something else again. But they have the feeling that he maligned Al Gore with a campaign that had its basis in a almost anti-intellectual appeal. You know, Al Gore is a godless man who wants to take away your guns. I mean, that's more blatant than some of the television stuff was. But nonetheless, that was the pitch as many of Gore's followers interpreted it. And I think that whoever the nominee of the party is against Bill Brock, there will be an opportunity to form a strong party coalition. I think if Ray Blanton were that nominee, for example, he could be the catalyst to bring the Democrats together. Really,
but you don't see him as the catalyst this year.
No.
Do you see anybody else on the horizon, or you just see the opportunity in 76 for somebody to emerge?
I just think that rocks that there is that negative factor that affects Democrats that are going to be going looking for a chance to beat Bill Brock. I think they take almost anybody who came out of that primary.
Is Fulton considered a prime candidate?
Well, he is by Fulton, I think. He would have been great this time if he had got the nomination. If he could have won, yeah, he would be able to inspire that sort of following. He really would. Yeah, I think he.
You think he'll run for the Senate in 60? In 76.
Well, he told me on the phone yesterday that if Baker announces he's going to run, he's going to announce him. If Baker is the vice president, I don't think that he's going to be. But he'll announce immediately that he's going to run for the Senate this year. So I would think, well, that...
If you lose it this year, which some people think you're
right,
Democrats are, the next opportunity is 1976, if you can find a candidate against Brock. Otherwise, what you're looking at really is a party that's almost leaderless, has been for 4 years, maybe
right.
For the next two, maybe the next 4 years.
That's right.
And what if the primary law doesn't get changed?
Yeah.
4 years down the road, aren't you looking at the same situation that you are now, Mr.
Yeah, you might be. You might be.
Looking at it as pessimistically
sure.
As you can.
Yeah, and I'm... Well, I am...
Is that law, by the way, a key to reuniting the party or getting a consensus within the party about some party or something?
I think having a runoff for one thing and then having party registration for another, I think both of those would be helpful factors.
You see those coming?
No, I think the part of the two facets to the problem, as I see it, I guess. On the one hand, you have the legislature, which sees itself as being the only viable, identifiable agency of the Democratic Party, elected agency of the Democratic Party. They've always considered the executive committee as, ineffective, ineffectual, almost out of it. And there has been a void. See, you've had, in effect, the governor has been the party. The governor named the state chairman, and most people never even, until the governors came into being, nobody even knew what the hell was the party was all about in Tennessee. Nobody ever questioned whether anybody had any rights within the framework of the Democratic Party. The executive committee met, formed those functions provided by law, canvassed ballots. Rare occasions, Fulton's first election, there was a vote scandal, absentee vote scandal, 1962. He ran against a man named Carlton Losa, who was an incumbent congressman. And there was a vote scandal, vote fraud uncovered, and this paper really was responsible, without question, for exposing it. And Fulton had 300 absentee ballots in town. He won that night by 52 votes without the counting of those ballots. When they were counted, he lost them 290 to 10. So he lost the election, but the exposure of the scandal surrounding those absentee ballots was so great that when the state executive committee met, the incumbent refused to accept the ballot and asked them to declare a new election, which they did. But aside from rare occasions like that, nobody's even known that there was an executive committee or that it had any function. Now, you have a Republican governor coming in. Everybody says, you know, well, what is the Democratic Party? You had, on one hand, you had this executive committee, then you had the legislators. They decided that the party was in debt and that they didn't expect any financing from the party, and so they set up their own fundraising devices, had a series of fundraising events, lobbyists kicked in dough, I'm sure. And they raised some money for themselves, outside the framework of the regular party. So you've had the legislature, which has come to view itself as an they come to see themselves as identifiable leaders of the Democratic Party. And they haven't really recognized the executive committee as being a helpful part of the machinery of the party. Yeah. Then on the other hand, you've had, I'll call it tomorrow. On the other hand, they passed a law which increased the number of members of the executive committee, thinking that this would somehow give more direction to the executive committee. Sasser has gradually gained some respect from the legislative leadership. But not enough to make them listen to him. I think when he says he wants a runoff law, those legislators worry about whether they're going to have runoffs. You know, we don't have a very good legislature, I don't think, and you don't have good Democratic Party leadership in the legislature.
Do most of the legislators and the people who have been around Democratic politics for a long time think that the 1970 election was kind of an accident, or that Dunn got elected sort of accidentally, and we're going to go back to the old Democratic way of doing things?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they think. Of course, if you analyze the 1970 election, to me, it's clear as a bell what happened. You hadn't had a Memphis governor in this century. You had a Democrat, two Democrats from Middle Tennessee. Albert's not, is rural Middle Tennessee before he's East Tennessee, right? The traditional districts, congressional districts that have been swing districts, have been the third and the ninth. We've lost a congressman, of course. But the ninth was Memphis and the third was Chattanooga and five surrounding counties. The third district, which was Brock's district, has been for about 8 years. Had been then for about 8 years. He was elected, I think.
Two.
Yeah. So 70, he's been in 8 years. So you have the third district was a swing district. And the ninth, Memphis, was a swing district. Shelby was a swing district. Brock held that seat and was elected and reelected, but there are not that many committed Republican votes in that district. I think they have a chance to knock Lamar Baker off this time, maybe not, but I think they have a chance. Well, if you look what happened in the third, Brock's district, when he was running for the Senate, went for him to the tune of about $15,000, $15,000 and $16,000 votes. Dunn's home district, Memphis, the ninth, the other swing district, went for him in the neighborhood of 40,000 votes, 35,000 votes. 30,000 votes. 30,000 votes. So between Memphis and Chattanooga are the third and the ninth. You've got 45,000-50,000 votes there. And that's almost the election. For Gore. I think Gore would have survived if he hadn't been running with Hooker or against the Memphis Republican. Hooker didn't do as well here as Democrats traditionally have. Carried the county against the Republicans, but it was close. Carried this district against the Republicans, but it was close. But Gore carried this county by 15,000 votes, carried this district by 15,000 votes. If he hadn't lost in Memphis, he'd been in. I'm confident he would have been in. But I agree with you. Many of them do think that it was an accident, that it was a freak. I don't think many of them really consider the geography as being the determinant of that election. But in my judgment, it was. You just look at those returns, and returns every year before, every election year before that. Clear to me that the combination of Dunn from Memphis and Brock from Chattanooga, third and ninth, what killed the Democrats. Killed the Democrats in 1970. To go back just a little bit, to go back again to the problem of the legislation and the legislature. And the legislature is seeing itself as the leadership of the Democratic Party. If you talk to McQuarrie and Wilder, they in effect will say, well, we don't have any, they said to me, we don't have any party leadership except what we're able to give. Jim Sass is a nice boy, but at the same time, they are not willing to provide any sort of party discipline even their own ranks. Wilder, for example, let the Republicans form a coalition with about four really old-line conservative Democrats and elect the state comptroller, Snodgrass. You all know about this?
No.
Well, you know, so you got a new governor in up there, who's a Republican for the first time, and you've got a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate. A young guy named Kephart, Floyd Kephart, television commentator, decides he's going to run for state comptroller, resigns his job at the television station, goes out and starts campaigning among the Democrats in the legislature. He beats the incumbent comptroller, Snodgrass, with the Democratic caucus. Beats him by a relatively heavy margin. I don't know, seems to me it was 8 or 10 votes, but he beats him. So you'd think that Kephart would be the nominee, that the caucus would go in, they'd hold party lines, the comptroller would win. Well, Harville and the two Bairds, members of the state Senate, joined with the Republicans and defected. And Snodgrass wins when the legislature votes on it. Wilder, the lieutenant governor, takes no action to discipline the defectors, gives them committee chairmanships, treats them as if they, well, I mean, he just wouldn't do anything, that, you know, he would take no action to deprive them of any of privileges, even though they helped the Republicans elect, keep the incumbent comptroller in office. So when they talk about leadership, particularly when Wilder talks about leadership, he doesn't really understand what's required. He's a nice man, he's a good fella, and these other fellas were nice guys, and he liked them. So no action was taken to encourage members of the legislature to hold party lines, members of the state Senate to hold party lines on critical votes. Now, you know, you can expect that on social issues, on ideological votes, or even votes where a special interest has moved in and take hold, and that's most of it. But on the question of party organization, you'd expect that they'd hold line or hold the line, or that something would, or that the leadership would take some action against them if they didn't. But it didn't. So while the legislature maintains, while the legislative leadership maintains that they're the identifiable represents the Democratic Party in the state, they're not really, you know.
Let me ask you this question about this election of these constitutional officers of the legislature. Mm. Each house votes separately on them?
No, they vote in it's a caucus.
Joint session?
Yeah, it's a joint session. First of all, there's a caucus and then a joint session. And they vote, but it was close, you see. It was close.
Oh, I see. So Snodgrass then had the universal support of the Republicans?
Yeah, down the line. I don't think he lost a vote. Kephart was a political scientist. I think he had taught down in Middle Tennessee before he became a television commentator. Really a bright young guy.
He was qualified.
No doubt.
My image of a typical TV commentator.
He's not.
Not a hell of a background.
I think he's well qualified. He's a little feisty, you know, and he came on a little strong, and he didn't go around and solicit support from those old-line Democrats. The three who defected were all let's see, Bill Baird must be in his 60s, Mr. Harville's in his 70s, and Ray Baird is approaching 60. They've been around for a long time, they like each other, and Floyd was a little, I mean, he came on too strong for him, I think. They liked Snodgrass. They voted for Snodgrass initially. Somebody saw this as an opportunity to.
Is that the first time that's happened, that the nominee of the caucus didn't get the position?
Yeah, but in the past, you see, it has been literally the tradition that the governor named those officers, which is unhealthy. Really unhealthy. I mean, the comptroller has as his responsibility the duty to audit all the agents of state government, all the executive officers of state government. That presumes an independent legislature that's going to elect a comptroller who is subservient to our fealty primarily to the legislative branch as opposed to the executive, so that he'd be free to go in and make searching.
Did Dunn want
Dunn did want him, yeah. Yeah. And I think that the result of that, I mean, there has not really been that much change. I mean, Kephart was saying around, you know, we're going to turn these departments of government inside out. When I get in there, we're going to have some searching audits of all these agencies. And the federal government has since returned indictments against some of the companies for aspiring to fix prices in printing. One audit that came out just a couple of months ago showed that there was some law violations in Commissioner Choate's department, which is industrial development. And Kephart was saying, you know, this is going to be the rule instead of the exception. And he was making pretty obvious, you know, that he was going to stir him up. Dunn was nervous as hell about Kephart. They all were. Very upset about it. Now, I think McCorda, Speaker of the House, held the line for him. But Wilder just let it slip away, and I never really understood why. Except that he is, as I said, such a nice man. He doesn't like to hurt anybody's feelings. So I think the legislature is a body that's going to provide.
Wilder need Republican support in the Senate to get elected?
Did who?
Wilder. No. Did he get it?
No. You see, he was elected in the caucus, and the caucus held the line for him. Ernest Crouch ran against him. He's got tough opposition this time because Crouch is coming back now. And
Crouch, a Democrat?
He's a Democrat from one of these rural counties around here. But he's been around a long time. And Wilder, I can't remember. Crouch might have capitulated the night before. I can't remember. But Wilder had the caucus. Now, his failure to act I think it's going to mean Crouch is going to give Wilder a tough run for the lieutenant governor's job this time.
So that could be a real test. Indicator.
It could be, that's right. But in my judgment, we're not ever going to have any real... We may not have a well-structured, viable Democratic Party in Tennessee in the absence of a governor, or in the absence of a leader who will rely on present party machinery. And I mean by that the executive committee.
He's not have to be the state chairman. He's not have to be in the legislature.
No, that's right.
He's going to have to be a candidate for statewide office.
He's going to have to be a candidate for statewide office.
So if Fulton or someone else were elected senator and you had a Republican governor, in effect, he'd become the titular head of the Democratic Party.
That's right. I envision if Blanton's elected, there's some... I haven't studied the makeup of the new executive committee too closely, but... there is going to be, I mean, there is at least semblance of some liberalism.
How is that Democratic Executive Committee selected?
By popular vote. See, they were elected this time.
What's their basis of representation?
The senatorial districts.
The senatorial districts?
Yeah, they're assigned according to the senatorial districts, that's right. And that's new. I mean, this is the first time they've been elected from senatorial districts.
Is that required by the national rules? Why did they change? What was it by counties before?
It was, let's see, no. Before, it's always been by, I think before it was by congressional district. Let's see, is that right? Man and a woman, and there's 36 of them.
When you had 9 congressional districts, that would be...
36 of them, so it must have, maybe it was 2 men and 2 women from each congressional district. Seems to me there's now a man and a woman from each senatorial district. And there will be at least a minority faction on that executive committee, should Blanton win, that, depending on his capacity to broaden his base, that will probably be hostile to him. Now, whether it's enough to elect a chairman, I just don't know. I suspect not. I would think that if Blanton were smart, he'd be willing to go along with Sasser. He really represents that other wing of the party. You know, I mean, Sasser is identified more closely with Albert Gore than with anybody else.
Who do you think is going to win in November?
I think it's a toss-up. I think it's an absolute toss-up. I think Blanton could have won if Nixon stayed in office and fought it for the last.
That was definitely a substantial help to Alexander.
I think it was,
right?
Yeah. No doubt about it. Alexander's more polished, much more intelligent. I'm convinced maybe more conservative than you're talking to. I'm almost ready to say it depends on how willing Ray Blanton is to broaden the base, his base of support. If he's willing to broaden his base of support, I think he could be the governor. But I think he's got to do it. Matt Lynch is the chairman of the state AFL-CIO, and I've had a couple of conversations with him. He says, you know, I think he's going to have one as the other at this point. Neither one of them shows me much.
Well, he ended up on a contribution list to Alexander.
$100, yeah. Yeah, he did. It was really an embarrassment to him. But I think he'd be willing to go for Blanton, and I think but Ray is going to have to make some, you know, it's really the classic case.
Turn out to be something. Is it really going to be enough to bring all those candidates and organizations together?
Those candidates are an interesting group of people. There are a couple of them that could be very tough for him. I mean, I would expect that Ross Bass, for example, will lay the law down to him on questions involving blacks. I would expect that Bass will say to him, I'm going to support you, but I'm warning you, unless you take some steps to convince black citizens that you're going to be a national Democrat, you're not going to be able to get them into this election. He lost something like 30-35% of the vote. And I there are some people in that meeting who will be a little tough with it. Could be. I don't know how they how it'll finally come out. So. But they could. But I would anticipate that some of them will maybe make some demands. They may wait till after. May just go along. But the press is there. They're going to. They're all going to be looking, and they all think they're smarter than he is. They all think they have more capacity to lead than he does. They all. There are very a few of them that are really generous, outgoing human beings. They're a jealous, greedy bunch of bastards, and I would think they could really give him some trouble tomorrow. I had one word of advice for Jim Sasser after the Sasser wanted to have this meeting 2 days after the primary.
That'd been murder.
I said, I think you're out of your mind. I said, if I were you, I wouldn't go in there. They'll all come in there. They'll be, you know, they'll still be suffering such pain, such withdrawal pain. They'll be angry as hell at each other, and they. It could be fun tomorrow, if he has not really made any effort to lay the ground rules. Lay out a set of ground rules, and if he has no commitment from them that they're not going to embarrass him, there's some of them that are really capable of creating a little trouble.
This is a unique experience for the Democratic Party, I say.
Sure is.
Have this kind of a meeting and a press conference.
That's right.
Who set it up, Blanton or Sasser?
Blanton set it up. And Blanton told me that, he's not the brightest fellow in the world. I am.